From Noble Robot on East Hennepin Avenue in dashing Minneapolis, this is Nice Games Club, the show where nice game devs talk games and game development. I'm Ellen Burns Johnson, and I make nice games.
I'm Steve McGregor, and I make nice
games. And I'm Arthur Croy, I too make nice games.
For this week's episode, our topics are asset management and double jump versus dash. And so, if everyone is ready, let's start.
Steven, you're a filmmaker now.
I mean, we haven't done the editing yet, but...
You're doing the making. It's happening.
We are doing the making, yes.
Tell us all about it.
Yeah, this Friday, I went with my group, and I'm lucky because I have a group. We have three people. Other people just have two people in their
this
group.
This is for the class you're taking?
This is for the class I'm taking, mm-hmm. Yes. I talked about it in a previous episode or two. Mm-hmm. I don't know. It's kind of neat. Before that, we did like a technical exercise where we just like filmed random stuff just so we knew how to set up the camera and how it worked. Mm-hmm. This time we actually filmed stuff so we can make we have a 1 minute film that we're supposed to make.
Yeah.
It has to be exactly 1 minute to the frame. So we did some footage for that. And it was fun. I managed the camera,
good,
which was neat.
Ooh. Director of photography, Stephen McGregor.
Yeah, I guess so. I don't know. It was just a fun experience because it's a different creative outlet than what I'm used to. I'm used to just using games. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I guess I've tried creative writing, but I don't like it. So I guess if I had to pick something else, maybe movies would be the way to go.
Uh-huh.
But
someone else can write them.
Yeah. Right, exactly.
That is a viable career path in filmmaking.
It is, yeah. I don't know. It was just really interesting to do that and like schedule the time. I think I've alluded to this on the show before too, but like I've definitely recognized more like the work that goes into making movies or TV shows and stuff now. Mm-hmm. I'll recognize a cut and I'll be like, why did they make that cut? And I guess my brain will never be the same, which is fine.
And now, sadly, you know.
Yeah. Now I know the work that goes into it.
As we record this episode, the one where you talk about that
just
came out.
Oh, right. Yeah.
And I listened back and I'm like, oh, yeah, Stephen was not looking forward to knowing stuff.
Yeah. I said it then. Say it now. Learning sucks.
Well, that episode ended with you with a much more positive attitude, so it's nice to see that you've reverted to the mean.
Yeah.
Do they, in this class, do they teach you about all the weird names that these different positions involved in filmmaking have, like grip?
No, actually. We haven't learned any of that kind of stuff yet, which would be nice. I definitely see that in the credits. I'm like, I still don't know what a grip is. Mm-hmm. What? There's like a best boy or whatever, isn't there? Or something?
Whatever that is.
Yeah.
They're part of the cinematography. They're electrical. They move things. They help set up equipment.
Oh, we don't need that then, because there's just three of us in student film.
I figured maybe kind of those kinds of roles are only needed for really big projects, but still, like... Yeah. You know,
yeah. I mean, I made a bunch of films when I was younger, and we had no one with those titles.
Cause
even though we had a crew of six, like it's just it's for bigger things.
Right.
You know, the people who gaffer down cables, like that's you, or someone you hire.
Yeah.
And if you hire them, they deserve a title.
It's anyone. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, and on big jobs, it's like that's why like unions in filmmaking is a big deal. Is because like it's when you can do it efficiently and competently rather than just like whatever, which is like most people can do whatever.
Right.
And they don't see the value in it. And that's one of the reasons why unions are so powerful in creative industries, because things can run so much more smoothly when you have people who are like good at the logistics of those seemingly simple tasks.
Right. For sure. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that makes sense.
Right. Because things that seem simple at a small scale become very complex at large scale.
Yeah. Yes. Yep. And every little inefficiency that you will never notice will add up.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
You know? Yep. And you're meant to be focusing on whatever, you know, artsy fartsy thing you want to capture on film, not the logistics.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Somebody has to manage all that. That's very important.
Yeah.
We don't have to deal with any of that, like I said, because it's a 1 minute project for a student, for a class. So, like, it's fine either way. I will be doing more filming. We're doing some editing tomorrow in class. thankfully, I will likely not be doing a lot of the actual video editing because one of my group members knows that stuff.
They're like into that part of it?
Yeah. So, but I'll be like around to help with if they need, if they have questions or anything.
That's such a fascinating part of this that is about learning filmmaking today.
Yeah.
Whereas back when I learned it, you know, through roughly experience and cobbling together whatever, which is how people do it today by like, you know, going on TikTok or whatever.
For sure.
But like the tools are so commoditized now.
Yeah.
Like it's not, I remember like getting a copy of Adobe Premiere, like not Adobe Premiere Pro, like Adobe Premiere version 5.5 or whatever it was back, you know, a million years ago. And like feeling like that unlocked a lot.
Sure.
That's not really true anymore. Like you have so much capability that and it could be you can really just focus a lot more on the fundamentals and the craft rather than the tools. The tools are still going to be what you need eventually.
Yeah.
But you can exercise a lot of creativity and you can learn a lot of the craft of it without a lot of gatekept tools.
Right.
And in my era, it was like the era of the DV camera. The mini DV like tape, which was meant like, oh my god, now anybody can make movies, and it was barely true. Like,
yeah,
it's a, you know, amazing how that compared to now, and that's I mean, it's really exciting. It must be great to be 19 years old.
I imagine so. I'll ask my my student group people.
In some respects, perhaps.
Yeah, for sure.
I am very glad to be on the back end of paying my student loans.
Yeah.
Rather than the front end of taking them on.
You know? Fair point.
Yeah. Good point. Sorry, what I meant to say is there must be great things about being
okay, fair, yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
My knees might not hurt.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I guess I'm happy that I've done my mortgage is paid off. Like
you're right.
And that happened in the past.
Yeah.
That's nice.
Yeah.
Other big news, we're delaying the start of the show because I think both of us, Stephen, you and I are like, well, maybe our topic's a little shorter today. So we have fun things to talk about. But this is really important, regardless of if our show is packed or not, which is when you hear this, it's maybe a week or two before the election. And so this is kind of our last chance to tell you, please go vote.
Yes.
If you haven't registered, if you're in a state, this is in the United States, of course, we do have international listeners. If you're in the United States and your state requires you to register in advance, please check what those deadlines are. It may have already passed for your state. I don't know how restrictive some are these days. Mm. And the reason I don't know that is because we live here in Minnesota. We have same day registration.
Right.
So if you're in Minnesota and there's a bunch of other states that have this as well, you can actually just bring your ID to the voting booth. And that's not voter ID. That's registration ID. You can register to vote if you've never voted before in Minnesota and a couple of other states. We'll put some show notes to provide some links on that. But if you're in a state where that does not have same-day registration, and most don't, I believe, still, that's something you got to do in advance. Hopefully it's not too late for you if you have not done that already, but it's really important you get out there.
Yeah.
We're not explicitly political on the show, but we don't hide our views. I'm happy to say, please vote for Kamala Harris and Tim Walz, our Minnesota governor for vice president.
Yeah.
I don't think we need to get too deep into why.
Right.
But I think if you have empathy for human beings, I think that's a start.
Yeah.
I think there's like wonky policy reasons why you might choose, but I think this is a time where, and I know it's exhausting to hear it, but like this is different from, you know, oh, you know what? I really prefer a conservative policy agenda. Like, I'm sorry, that's not a good excuse.
Yeah.
And I'm happy to plant my flag, even though this is not what this program is for.
We didn't get this opportunity to do that in 2016,
right?
Because we had started
when
right
the show
after.
Started.
Yeah.
We had like just missed the opportunity to make an impact on that.
Yes.
As if we could have.
Yeah.
And I don't, have illusions that we will now, but you know, we have a platform, so. Mm. I'll leave also to the two of you to say anything about it, but I think...
I mean, fully agreed.
Yeah.
There's a difference between a conservative policy agenda and, like, an insane agenda.
Yeah.
And maybe that's not the appropriate way to phrase it for the show. But I would like for us to return to a time where we at least have, like, a couple options to choose from that are moderately reasonable.
Yeah.
And I think we need to send a pretty strong message to certain areas of country leadership that we would like that.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's the very minimum what voting for you know, Harris Walz does. Personally, like, those policies are mine. But, you know, speaking more broadly, that's kind of how I feel about it.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm so. Right with you. Like, there's policy arguments to be had, but that I'm uninterested in making those right now.
Yeah.
If you're like, hey, you know, and particularly on the left, the Democratic administration's response to the war in Gaza is extremely mixed. I mean, I have a lot of sympathy mm-hmm. for the Biden administration's dilemma, but they've also not done what, you know, every step that I would have liked them to. And I think there's mm-hmm. a lot of merit to the activists who are really pressuring the current administration and, you know, pressuring the Harris campaign to do better or promise better. And I don't know that they're getting everything they want from that pressure campaign. And so I think it's so that's just one example. Yeah. I don't mean to make this about that. Yeah. But I think independent of that, like Ellen said, there's a difference between policy disagreement and, you know, sort of, they hate to say it, but just like foundational, you know, existential realities of our democracy.
Mm.
I mean, there is a reason why the villain of the 21st century, Dick Cheney, is supporting Kamala Harris. There's a reason. And it's not because he would agree with anything she would do in office.
Yeah.
Right? Like, he probably thinks right. that her agenda would harm the country. And yet he is publicly supporting her and will vote for her. Like, that's the level we're at.
Yeah.
And this is, for a lot of people listening, it's probably, you've heard all this before. You probably agree with a lot of it. For folks who don't, hopefully, if you think of it on that level, if you're thinking about staying home because this is annoying, this is where I think, this is the pressure I will apply to you.
Yeah.
Is it matters more than it usually does. And I know that every election feels that way. And elections are that way when it comes to policy.
Right.
These things are real. If you have disagreements with Harris or with Trump or with anyone, like, that has a real impact on what the future will look like. But I think independent of that, if you want to continue to have these debates in 4 years and 8 years and so on, I think it matters that you vote for the country, right?
Mm-hmm.
And yeah. It's hard to say that in a way that is believable. So I anyone who's skeptical of, like, you know, of that, I appreciate that as well. But anyway, elections in a couple of weeks, fingers crossed.
Register to vote.
Yes, please. And we'll put links in the show notes if you haven't been very engaged, there's nothing to be embarrassed about. We'll provide some links. And there's lots out there as well that'll be, you know, what we provide probably won't be everything that will be of value, but we'll do our best to be one more source for you to make this easy to participate.
Because
it's pretty easy to participate. And a lot of places do early voting, where you don't have to wait until the day and find a time in your work day to do it, because election day is still not a holiday, which is a separate issue. But
yeah.
Oh, yeah. It's a related issue. I will say, in most of for the U.S., some parts of the U.S. make it easier to vote than others. Right. Fortunately,
yes.
In Minnesota, it's one of the places where we make it really easy to vote. So I'm going to be at a work event on voting day, so I'm going to have to vote early, which I'm pretty pumped about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah,
because I don't know, cross things off the list. Feel good about it.
Yeah,
yeah.
Get my sticker.
Yeah, that's my plan too. Early voting here, from where we're sitting, started last week, and I'm trying to find a time for Dale and I to go together because it's a thing we like. We like to go together, and our schedules don't always line up, so it's nice to do. And there's a bunch of places in Minneapolis, so we're lucky. Not everybody is. Some people have to do. It's easier for us, and that's reflected in the fact that our voter participation is so high.
Right.
It is not, as much as my fellow Minnesotans would like to say, is because we are we are better citizens than
anyone. No, yeah.
It is because it is easier for us.
Right.
That is why we participate more.
Yeah.
And so if it's not easy for you, then, you know, that's tragedy for your area. And hopefully you can put in the effort that you need to make it happen. And you will feel better having participated.
Yes.
You know?
Tragedy is such a gentle term for that.
Yeah.
I am outraged on your behalf if you have to stand in line and people can't bring you water.
Yeah.
That is insane.
Yeah.
But yeah.
Exactly right. Yeah.
And it showcased just how easy it is to spin out into, like, issue after issue. It's all connected.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yes.
And so if you care about anything, I think, like, they didn't talk about the mic issues, I don't agree with them on any of these things. You're not picking a spouse. Right.
Yeah.
You're signaling a direction.
Yes.
I think so. It doesn't necessarily matter. I mean, it matters, but it's not necessarily existential that the person you choose is the person you would want to lead the country like a dictator. which is maybe another reason why you should vote for Harris, is because that's not exactly what the other side is saying. So it makes it really easy to say, like, well, you don't agree 100%, you know. And it, which isn't to say you should compromise. If you have a severe disagreement, that's between, you know, you and your conscience. Whether you can, and I'm trying to be as, I'm not trying to be persuasive in a policy sense.
Yeah.
Because I don't think that's, one, that's not what the show is about. But also, I think what I want to talk about specifically is just about, like, this is about the process of government.
Right. The process of government doesn't work unless people participate in it.
Exactly right. And so, you know, third party votes, protest votes, sitting at home, those signal more than they do in other years, I think. And that sucks to hear if that's something that if that's how you want to participate. That sucks to hear that that is counterproductive. But this year in particular, it really, really is. And I don't feel as much as I'm not trying to, you know, lay out a policy persuasion, I think I'm pretty comfortable saying that those are counterproductive ways to spend voting day. So exciting.
Yeah.
Get out there and vote, feel good about it. Cause it is kind of exciting.
Like, yeah.
You know, it's all our lifetimes it's been true, but like, it's kind of wild that like, you know, we do get to decide how this country works, you know, at a way for the hundreds of millions of people, you know, in the United States, to be able to participate at the level that any of us individually can is actually kind of amazing. Yeah. And we, you know, in game development, we deal with like numbers and how things influence other things and smoke and mirrors and just like how things work and how they appear to work.
Yeah.
And I think we don't always appreciate how valuable just the ability to vote is.
Yeah.
Even if it is hard, that is such an incredible power everyone has. Because it needs to be diluted amongst all these people. And the fact that everyone has a little bit of a voice is actually kind of miraculous. So as scary and as frightening and as, you know, annoying as this all can be, it should also be really inspiring and exciting.
Yeah. I mean, I'm looking forward to going out and voting.
Yeah. And of course, we can all say this with a sense of optimism because we're on this side of it.
Yeah.
Talk to us in a couple of weeks. Let's see how it goes.
Uh-huh.
But it's up to all of us together as a group.
Absolutely.
All right, my topic is pretty dry this week.
Okay.
I'm starting to bounce around between a lot of things in the work I'm doing.
Yeah.
I'm fairly, I want to say, stressed vocationally this fall. There's a lot going on. I'm at the point now where I have like many things with deadlines that I have to say like, all right, this is urgent, but this is also urgent. So this is set aside. And like that is, and I have to like really budget, you know, it's very stressful. But what that means for our listeners, which is good news, is that I'm bouncing around between a lot of different things.
Yeah.
So I have things to bring to the show. And what I'm working on this week is asset management.
Okay.
So I think we've talked about this on the show before. We might have done, I don't know if we've done a whole topic on it, but basically, you know, how do you load assets into your game at runtime and show them and use them. And this is a thing where when you start making games, you might have shipped a game or two before you realize that you need to engage with this topic.
Yep, I know I have.
Because a lot of the tools that you use will sort of let you get by. Mm-hmm. And that's a great thing. But like many things in game development, once you realize you have to deal with it, suddenly you're like, oh my God, I had no idea how much there is to deal with.
Yeah.
And so...
just like the best boy.
A little bit. Yep.
Okay. It's all connected.
Yep. And so I just describe a little bit of what I'm dealing with right now. So on Dream Settler, the game is about a fake internet. And so a big part of it is content. So we have web pages. We have lots and lots of music in the game. And then we also are planning for downloadable content. So what we need is a system that can handle all that content without loading it all at launch, and also being able to be arbitrary so that in the future we can add some amount of additional content and the game can handle that without having to update the game itself too much.
Yeah.
The other project I'm working on, which hasn't been announced yet and I've sort of talked vaguely about, it has a lot of video.
Yeah.
Like, hours of video content are in it, and that's a big part of how the game works. And so the asset management for that is especially important because we want it to be multi-platform, which I've talked about on the show before, and perhaps maybe even on mobile one day.
Ooh.
And perhaps some of the content can be deployed remotely So you don't have to download all of it at once.
Yeah.
We're not committed to that, but I want to make sure that if suddenly we decide to go that route for certain platforms that we can.
Yeah.
And so it's been on my mind this week in particular, because I'm looking to do an internal a demo for that pretty soon. And so the areas of interest for this topic are organizing your project, where do you actually put these things, and then how do you optimize the disk space that your game takes up, and then how do you optimize the RAM that it uses at runtime.
Ooh, I'm particularly interested in the disk optimization.
Yeah?
Gamers complain about that a lot, even they don't have any understanding on how it works.
Yeah.
But I don't know how it works either, so I want to know.
Let me just get then experiences from the two of you.
Okay.
On just what, because it's a lot of it is abstracted away.
Yeah.
So let's hear from both of you, like how you have ever had to deal with this in the past.
I mean, I guess all of my released games come from Unity, unless they're game jam games. And so I mean. Within this topic, we're talking about like things like asset bundles, right, and addressables.
Yes, that's what we'll get into that.
Yeah. So like I've used those. I used that for Treasure Stack, for instance. Mm-hmm. But I know I used it wrong because I basically just loaded everything up at the beginning.
Yeah.
All of the asset bundles. I don't fully understand when things are supposed to, like when you should load stuff and when you should not load stuff until you need it.
Yeah.
So like that's the kind of thing that I've been trying to deal with. Additionally, I've never really had a limitation with respect to like the size of a game.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas I imagine, Ellen, because a lot of your games are browser based.
Yeah.
You have like you definitely have to be concerned about like the size of assets that are being loaded and things like that.
Yeah. I've run into that a few times. The other thing is in the curriculum setting, a lot depends on how you break things up and where you want bookmarking, right? So like, if you're doing something that's part of a curriculum or something that encompasses an entire curriculum, that also impacts like the size of your files.
Yeah.
So just to give two contrasting examples, three maybe, you know, when we did Noodle, I don't even think we needed a Phaser for that. I think when we do some of our more physics-based browser learning games, we've been using Phaser.
Okay.
Phaser.io, we can link to that in the show notes, but that's pretty lean, very browser friendly, but not a lot of assets. Mm-hmm. A recent game that we did had a lot of different assets. We had this like steampunk mansion, and that's pretty exciting.
Yeah.
Like, but lots of different assets, lots of textures, but the textures were all embedded into images because of the tool we needed in order to build it. And that was a tool that game devs are probably not very familiar with called Storyline. And it's optimized for rapid interactive learning development. And we've kind of pushed it to it. We pushed it pretty hard to be able to produce that game. But that still ran just fine. It wasn't long. It was like a 20-minute experience. So even though we had a lot of videos, we had a lot of imagery, like it didn't end up being very heavy.
Mm.
Where we really started running into the limitations of that tool is when we had to produce an entire curriculum.
Okay.
And it needed to be gamified. So like in between lessons, they would return to this city where they were building things. And it all had to be done in that Storyline development tool. And so it took a while for that thing to load.
Yeah.
And it wasn't so much the asset management. I think that it was just not what the tool was meant for.
Right.
Yeah.
But it's related, I think, you know.
Yeah. Actually, so very specifically, like a good segue into sort of how broadly how these things can be done.
Yeah.
Because very often you will encounter those limits when you start, when you are sort of given systems that sort of work out of the box.
Mm.
You don't always know what their limits are. They're not really heavily advertised.
Yeah.
I don't mean that cynically. I mean that it's just not actually valuable to tell people about that before they know how a tool works.
Right.
Like, so it's not, you know, but you do end up wondering like, why did I know this already? Then why this huge topic out of nowhere? Like, well, it's just because you didn't need it up until then. You reached the limit, and there's something exciting about having reached a limit.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you could be happy of that. But yeah. Basically, I think what you were describing, Stephen,
yeah,
with Unity, and Ellen, what you were describing, if I'm reading right, with some of the tools you're using, is the idea that like you can kind of, the expectation is that the tool doesn't know when you're going to need assets.
Right.
And so it tends to just assume, just to give all of them to, make them all available to the runtime.
Yeah.
Whatever runtime that is, whether it's Unity, whether it's a browser, whether that's something else. Mm-hmm. And so what that means is loading all that stuff into RAM. I think for browser stuff, there's it's a little different. I think browser games usually have, because browsers are fundamentally about retrieving assets.
Yeah.
There's a little bit of an advantage there, and so the connection might be a little bit more metaphorical. But similarly, the platforms and tools you use don't have any idea if you're going to be like, how many levels do you have? When do you need them? Do you go from level 1 to level 3 to level 2? And so you need levels to come in any order. And so they just do not make any assumptions. And so what that tends to mean is that you sort of just have everything at once. And in Unity, and in a lot of other things, what that means is everything is compiled into the executable. And so that means, and you'll see this for lots of other engines as well, where you'll be like, you'll compile a build and you'll just end up with an exe file.
Yeah.
And maybe a couple of ancillary metadata pieces. But when you see that and it's this big exe file, that can feel kind of nice. Like, oh, great, it's all nice and tidy. But what that means is that when you load it, all of that needs to go into RAM.
Right.
And now the thing about that's interesting about it, and maybe not even that kind of not scary, is that especially if you're indie, mm-hmm. Computers have a lot of RAM these days.
It's true.
And this would, I mean, you know, 20 years ago, this kind of idea wouldn't have been as, you would have had to learn this sooner.
Yeah.
Basically. And so the cheapest laptops like have like 8 gigs of RAM, right? And, you know, no game executable is 8 gigabytes.
Yeah.
Right? And when you're using games, you're likely not using much else.
Yeah.
You know, maybe you're using Discord and that's using a lot of RAM. Maybe you're using Chrome and that's using a lot of RAM.
Yeah.
But like, generally, it's not always a problem. Mm-hmm. And so I want to lead off with that because I don't want people to be like, well, that's what I do and it's fine. Do I really need to learn this whole system for my, you know, 150 megabyte executable with a bunch of assets? Like, well, you're probably fine.
Yeah.
Like, it's okay.
Yeah.
And so when you were saying in Treasure Stack, you loaded all that stuff.
Yeah.
The Switch could handle that.
Right. Yeah. The game was not very big. It was like, I want to say it was like 300 megabytes or something.
So, yeah.
Yeah. It's relatively small.
And that was similar to how we did it with Widget Satchel. I broke up Widget Satchel into asset bundles.
You did,
then,
yeah.
And then I didn't load everything at once, but I loaded more things than I planned to.
Yeah.
Because it ended up not being a problem.
Yeah.
At launch. Mm-hmm. And then you don't have to worry about doing it while the game is running, and right. We'll talk about that in a bit.
And Widget Satchel significantly bigger, but still not that big.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly right. And it's because it wasn't that big.
Right.
So I think it's important to learn this stuff, but also I think, and I fall victim to this, when I learn a new thing, I just want to use it.
Yeah.
You don't always have to use it. But that's the first way to do it. Compile it into a binary. Easy peasy.
Okay.
The other way to do it is to load assets off disk from runtime. And this is also very common. In Unity, you end up with a folder called Streaming Assets.
Yeah.
Sort of a special folder that is the API is very familiar with. You can load assets from anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
But that's something you'll see. And what that means is those assets just get put into the folder of the build. Right. When you compile a Unity project, you have all the stuff in your project, but most of that stuff doesn't end up in the build. Only the stuff that's needed.
Yeah.
So your project can be really messy, but only the stuff that's referenced will get compiled into the binary, and then everything in the streaming assets folder will get copied. And the reason that happens is because Unity says, oh, okay, that's a special folder. That's just files you want to have available. We don't need to check that you need it.
Right.
And then you can just, that's the stuff you can load right off disk. It doesn't get compiled, doesn't get changed. Now, that can be a problem for some people because you're like, well, that could have, people could look in those folders and see what's in there. They could accidentally delete one of those files and then the game breaks, right?
Like, yeah.
So, you know, some of it is about, obfuscation or protection for your project, but some of it is just about functionality, right?
Mm-hmm.
You need all these individual files. If you have a game with lots of 3D models and textures and stuff, and they're all just sitting on disk, that's fine, but then the game becomes kind of fragile.
Yeah.
Right. Not just to people accidentally deleting things, but also like hard disk problems,
yeah.
File trees, stuff like that. Now that could also happen just as easily with it all compiled into one binary, but then you'll see the problem.
Yeah.
Right. So there's drawbacks, but the plus of it is that it's very simple, right? Mm-hmm. You in your API, you just say I load this off this place. If you know where the folder is. And you can expect it in a certain place. You can just load it right at runtime. deal with it and then dispose it if you don't need it anymore. And so that's a pretty common way to handle it as well.
Yeah.
But it is a problem when you have lots of little assets.
Yes.
Because then you're basically doing lots of calls every time you need something, when it would be nice to be able to have it all into memory at once and then deal with it as the runtime goes and not have to be streaming off of disk all the time.
Yeah.
So this is definitely true for things like sound effects and like sprite sheets.
Yeah. I was going to say, in Treasure Stack, that's how we used streaming assets to load all of the animations for the little characters that we were running around. And because like there were so many different characters, this was the easiest way for us to do it. We had a naming convention for all of the sprites.
Yeah.
And then we would load based off of the name of the character you're playing as. Mm-hmm. And we'd load that in during runtime.
Yeah. And you want that as a sprite sheet. So you're loading one bitmap file and not 70.
Right. Yeah. Right? Yeah.
And that's probably underselling it.
Yeah.
Right. And so it's just one disk operation. And that's great. Also, what's cool about that is that you can also make modding really easy.
Yeah.
You can just go. This is how it usually worked in the Quake days, right? Mm. You just go in and just modify a file on disk. And then you load up the game. And there you've modified the game.
Yeah.
That's fun, right? That's the crudest way to do it, but that also, that system allows you as a developer to make tools for it as well that can be really easy for users to use.
Yeah.
Whereas if you compile all those things, then one, players can't edit them, and two, the game has no way of like reading in new assets, because it could read in a new asset off disk, but then what is it supposed to do with that asset? How does it integrate it? Because the asset it replaces is a different, so the APIs are different. So it's not just about structure, but it's about just your ease of developer workflow. So in Widget Satchel, we did for the PC version, I built an entire Steam Workshop, the system for making custom socks.
Oh, so I didn't know that. Or I did, but I forgot.
Well, we didn't ship it in the game.
Oh, okay.
Because
maybe that's why I didn't know.
Like, the feature was done.
Yeah.
I just like decided that like there was just one or two little extra things. I'm like, whatever. Mm. Like, it was different from how all the other assets worked.
Sure.
And so I just didn't wire up the last two things. And I think I was pretty busy or something.
Yeah.
As I'm talking about it, I'm like, why didn't I do that? But like, I'm trust myself that it was the right decision. Mm. I guess probably at the time I thought we would do a lot more updates and that would be an easy one to finish. And so that's why I didn't finish it then. But that was something that would be, you basically would load something off disk, but I had built a little interface for it. So users didn't have to manually do it. They had a template file that they could draw their socks on, and then it would load the asset in, and then the game would then cut it out into the right shapes and stuff to be able to make the thing. And that's really fun, but that only worked because it allows for loading assets in that way.
Yeah.
Whereas the rest of the assets in the game were all bundled. So they'd be more optimized, and so it was a different system for doing the same thing. So that's kind of tricky. It's sometimes nice to be able to just use one system for everything. Mm-hmm. So that's sort of the ups and downs of that one. And the last thing is a sort of best and worst of both worlds.
Okay.
which is essentially what in Unity world is called an asset bundle.
Yeah, yeah.
In the old Doom days, it was called a WAD.
okay.
Which is hilarious because it's just a wad of assets, like, you know, like a wad of paper.
Yeah.
But it is essentially a compiled binary. Sometimes it's a zip file with a different extension for funsies, and it isn't that obfuscated. That is essentially gets loaded in, and then it contains many assets.
Yeah.
So this is like a sprite sheet, but it's more at the byte level rather than within the file itself.
Yeah.
This is something that Unity has been pushing for years now. It's still, I would say, something every project I have to refresh myself on how it works.
Yeah.
Because it's not part of the normal workflow of a Unity game, frustratingly. It's a lot easier to use than it used to be. Working with it this week on both of my projects in two different versions of Unity, I was like, oh, this is much better than what we had to cobble together for Widget Satchel.
Yeah, yeah. Addressables before were confusing and, kind of a mess.
Yeah.
But asset bundles are much, much simpler because, you can just, link to a thing based off of the file, the location of the file. You can kind of
navigate to it. In Unity, and this isn't going to be a full primer on the addressable system.
Yeah.
But in Unity, basically, you assign an asset in your project to an addressable or asset bundle group, which becomes a big file that lives in a folder in your games folder, right? So it's kind of similar to assets just sitting in the streaming assets folder on disk, but they're a compiled binary of your data. So they're a little harder to accidentally break or decompile for users interested in poking around, which I is like a concern some people have. I have way less of a concern, but it is real for some folks.
Yeah.
The other benefit of that is that it then has the Unity API for managing it in a way that's simple for the developer. So you have this compiled binary of grouped assets together. And then it's called addressables because each asset has an address.
Yes.
And the address can be anything you want. But by default, the address is the file path that it exists in your project. And that is purely arbitrary. But it's because those are unique addresses, it becomes so it's like an ID system, basically. Mm. But not having to use GUIDs or hash tables or anything complicated. It's human readable.
Yeah.
And so you would want to group lots of assets together either by type or by context. So you put all of the level ones assets together. But then sometimes you need some level one assets in level two. So this is a thing we did for Widget Satchel, which is all a lot of the sprites that we need for the enemies, which are in all the levels, that becomes, I put that in a separate bundle that is like the levels bundle that all the levels need.
Yeah.
And you load that early on and you keep that in memory the whole game.
Right.
But level one, the actual level, which references all those assets and many more, it only contains the bundle for that, only contains the stuff that are in level one.
Right.
You're never going to need that when you're not in level one. So when you leave level one, we can unload that.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Now, when you're working in Unity in particular, and other systems have this as well, you will find sometimes when you use the same assets in multiple scenes or contexts, you end up having duplicates in your binary. Mm. This was a problem for Unity game for a long time, whereas the way it worked by default to make it easier for people is if it was referenced in a scene, then it would be compiled into that scene, which would then be put into the binary of executable.
Yeah.
So if you had a lot of the same things in level one and level two and level three, then there would be individual copies would be made for all three of those levels. And you wouldn't really know that.
Yeah.
And that was a sort of an ease of use, right? But if you assign an address to those assets and load them separately from the levels, suddenly your game goes from 500 megabytes to 70 megabytes.
Yeah.
And you'll be like, how did that even happen? It's because it's just duplicate assets, right? Mm-hmm. Because it's actually quite efficient to duplicate assets in terms of structuring. It's all about trade-offs.
Yeah.
Right? If you have a much bigger... people talk about this in storing data on physical disks and tape. Is it faster? Is it worse to duplicate some content on this part of the disk? Or do we save the time having to find it on another part of the disk? It'll be much faster if we have it in three places.
Right.
Then it'll be less to actually seek physically to find it.
Yeah. That makes sense.
But then the cost is having
more. Three of them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so there's tons of data science around doing this for like optical media and hard disks and all sorts of different things about how to actually optimize that sort of deduplication versus processing. Mm-hmm. I would not condemn any game developer to have to think about that too much in their game.
Yeah.
Engines can handle some of that, but trying to think a little bit about reducing some of that duplication when it's not required is nice. And that's a value of asset bundles is you organize things by context and not necessarily always by type. So a lot of mistakes people make is I'm going to make an asset bundle of all my textures, an asset bundle of all my models, an asset bundle of all my... That's great, but you need some textures and models and some scriptable objects in every part of your game.
Right.
So you need all of those things loaded all of the time.
Yeah.
And so that is, something that you have to think about the structure of your...
So you kind of have to think of it in terms of like siloing off certain aspects when you... This is me. I don't actually know this. I'm asking it.
Uh-huh.
Is that the case where like you kind of have to think of, if you think of it as like, I only need these things in this particular instance. I don't need them in other instances. So this should all be in an asset bundle because I will be loading it during this level or during this period of time in the game. And I can unload that after the fact and that'll use up less resources.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. And all of that is really... The benefit of that is memory footprint.
Yeah, okay.
So this is an area where you want to assess, like, where is this thing running? Mm. If it's running on a console, then you have a very specific understanding of how much memory it has.
Yeah.
And you could actually just query, like, as you're playing, like, oh, well, you know what? I can keep loading stuff, and I don't worry about it. It's okay to do things wrong if you've got some headroom.
Yeah.
On PC or mobile, you're not going to know. So you're going to have to get an understanding of the range of things. This is why we have system requirements.
Yeah.
And to understand, or you could just optimize it as much as possible without having to worry about hitting a target, just sort of get as good as you can go.
Yeah.
And then that becomes your minimum requirement.
Yeah.
So there's different ways to sort of handle that. But that's the other thing that is probably outside the scope of this just early 101 topic, which is just actually the hygiene of loading and unloading assets with, you know, your API of choice. Mm-hmm. We'll link some resources on how to do that within Unity in particular, because that's what I've been working with lately.
Yeah.
When to load and unload. Do you do that as soon as you don't need something or just a little bit? How do you design your game so that you actually understand what the player needs and when? Because you actually may realize as you start putting this together that you don't know that as well as you think you do.
Yeah.
Like, oh, I don't actually know if the player is going to need this right now. And so you have to kind of imagine all the use cases and all the scenarios, and then maybe give yourself a little bit of headroom, a little bit of leeway, load things you might not know that you need, but could guess maybe you might need. And for games that are wide open, that are not quite as linear, you're going to know less. You're going to be able to imagine fewer of your edge cases.
Yeah.
And so think about that. Think about error handling. What happens if an asset needs to be loaded and isn't? Mm-hmm. Do we throw an error? Do we involve the user at any point? Do we just try to scramble and load the thing anyway, and then we just get a whirligig on screen and, you know, while we solve this edge case?
Yeah.
If it doesn't happen a lot, maybe that's fine. If it happens a lot, then maybe we should work to make it so that it happens less. Mm-hmm. These are all things you would learn in QA and playtesting.
Yeah.
But for indie games, I mean, it's making it sound like a big deal. But like, again, if your whole game fits into, 60 megabytes, you can load it all at once. Who cares?
Yeah. At that point, it kind of doesn't matter.
Yeah.
So it's hard to know when you're screwing up. So it helps to know more about this so you can make informed decisions.
Yeah.
Because you'll get a lot of advice specifically, like keep it under this or do this or work it this way, but your game is different.
Right.
And ask around. Everyone's dealt with this. And so see what other people have done.
True.
And see what lessons you can learn and what lessons don't apply to you.
Yeah. I'm curious, actually, if there's folks in our Discord channel, if they have opinions or thoughts on this particular topic.
Yeah, if you've got stories, because these things can be doozies,
mm-hmm.
And experiences, please share them. Nicegames.club/Discord.
Yeah.
So, I think we're like we're in like the top 5% of podcasts or something like that.
Yeah.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Some of that is because there are so many podcasts.
Yeah.
But yes, we are in terms of we're up that sliding scale pretty high, which is nice.
Yeah.
Doesn't mean it's a big podcast. Because it gets really big after us.
Yeah.
Yes. Yes. There are some really big ones out there. Those really big ones also have more resources so they can, hire staff.
Yeah, you cannot imagine what we don't have compared to those podcasts.
Right. Lots. That's one of the things we actually use the Patreon money that we get to pay for, right? We have a little bit of office stuff we have to pay for, and we have a little bit of staffing we need to pay for. Thank you, Max.
Mm-hmm.
And we also have like the technical infrastructure. So the website needs to be somewhere, and that costs stuff. I went through this week and I actually like turned off an old website that I had created a few years ago for my contracting and instructional design, and I hadn't been doing that for a while. So I'm like, okay, I don't need to be paying this anything for this. And I was like, how much am I paying for this? It's actually, you can pay a lot if you want to.
Yeah.
So there are these kind of low-end recurring costs for running a podcast, even one that is relatively small / relatively big like ours. And so if you want to help us out, help defray some of those ongoing costs, please jump on Patreon. So you can go to patreon.com/nicegamesclub and you can donate any amount. When I say any amount, I mean, yeah, like $100 if you want. Or like what?
That's an amount.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah, those are amounts that you can donate. So whatever you feel comfortable with, and I think you can donate a one time. Can you donate one time?
You know what? You're going to have to go to patreon.com/nicegamesclub and check.
Oh, I like that tactic, Mark. Make them find out on their own.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's not really hard. It'll take you a couple minutes, and we really appreciate it.
Why do so many dogs die before their time? Actress and dog activist Katherine Heigl, who's helped save over 16,000 dogs through her foundation, says she's seeing more issues with dogs' joints, odors, and health than ever before. And after doing a ton of research, she feels there's one place we can look to support any dog's health: their food. So she decided to create something she could actually feel good about feeding her dogs. Superfood Complete by Badlands Ranch is made with over 30 of the healthiest ingredients on the planet, including premium protein-packed beef, nutrient-dense organ meat, heart-healthy salmon, gut-healthy vegetables, and several superfoods vital to your dog's health. And because high-heat cooking can add unhealthy things to your dog's food, Superfood Complete uses air drying, so it gets cooked low and slow. This means it has the convenience of kibble, but the health benefits of whole foods. If you want your dog to experience all these incredible benefits, go to BadlandsRanch.com/save50 right now to get up to 50% off your order and a 90-day money-back guarantee. Again, that's BadlandsRanch.com/save50 today. All dogs are unique. Your dog's results can and will vary.
People are driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search. Match with Indeed. The hiring process can be slow and overwhelming. Simplify hiring with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. Listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/PODKATZ12. That's Indeed.com/PODKATZ12. Terms and conditions apply.
All right. It's time for Stephen topic that's very specific, because from the other hosts have been requested to do these more frequently. So I've chosen the topic of double jump versus dash.
Yeah.
And I'm not talking about alternative jumps. I don't know. What is it? You said something about alternative jumps. Are there other alternative jumps?
Oh, I was just asking if there's like movement mechanics or something.
Oh, you know? No. It's just double jump and dash. That's the topic.
And how they are opposed in some way.
They're not.
Stop trying to expand the scope, Mark. Double jump and dash.
I just want to get to the bottom of this versus.
Well, okay. So the reason I put versus on here is because, well, oftentimes you don't. I guess you can do both, and a lot of games do. But
that's its own problem.
That's its own problem, I suppose. But I think that you, in particular, Mark, you had brought up that to me at some point that you don't like dashes and you prefer double jump.
Oh yeah, I realize that I'm essentially alone on this, but I love platformers. Platformers are my jam. That is the core. When I think of a video game, this is not unusual, but like, as much as I want all video games to be artsy fartsy, like when the thing that I play most and love most is platformers.
Yeah.
And I hate the dash.
Yeah.
I think it's an abdication of the platforming genre.
Okay.
Like, it is.
That's why I put the verses.
Yeah.
I don't feel that strongly about it. Yeah. I feel like,
I mean, if you want to let me loose, I mean,
I do actually. Yes.
Your funeral, but.
That's part of why I had I wanted this topic.
Yeah,
we could talk about it. But I wanted to, I mostly want to talk about the what differentiates these two concepts, and why you should use one or the other. Because like I think in general games have kind of leaned more towards dashes than double jumps.
Yeah,
which I'm sure Mark is upset about.
Correct.
But I think that like there's a lot of merits to both ideas.
Sure.
And it's worth revisiting periodically, I think. And so we're going to take this opportunity on the show to talk about that.
Yeah.
So what I mean when I talk about a double jump, I mean when you jump and then you press the A button or whatever button again, and then it jumps again. That's the double jump.
Yeah.
In air. Yes. Right. Specifically
for the folks who are unfamiliar with double jump.
Well, I want to be clear though, because there are different kinds of double jumps that are sort of double jumps. Like a rocket jump is not a double jump, even if you do that in the air.
Right.
It's a different thing than what I'm talking about.
Yeah. It's a double height jump or whatever.
Yeah. Yeah.
Very clear on the program.
Yes. So that's a double jump. And then a dash is when you move in a straight line in a direction for a brief period of time, typically in the air, but you can also do this on the ground.
And often it is in the place of, well, you're already jumping.
Yes.
Which is, I guess, why it's one or the other in a lot of games.
Yeah.
Often you can do it on the ground pretty frequently in most of these games.
Right.
But generally, it's a jump then dash.
Yeah. Sometimes games have jump, and then you press the jump button again, and you will dash in a direction. A lot of times, they come with their own dash button. because it requires it, because dashes are a little more complicated. And that's part of what I want to get into, is like, I think a lot of what the benefit to double jump to me is the simplicity of double jumps. It's easier for players to understand. It's easier to implement because you literally just jump again. And it's easier to control and manage. You only really require one additional button to do it in a way that I think that like is really valuable. Like if I think Mario games in particular, they don't typically do double jumps. You'll do like flying or whatever when you have like the super cape.
Yeah, I think Mario Wonder had something. One of its badges was a double jump.
Yeah, I think you're right.
But even that might have been not. But yeah, it's sparingly.
Yeah.
Contextually.
But like Mario is a game that feels like it would make sense to have a double jump and would not make sense to have a dash. Because I think Mario games tend to lean towards simpler in terms of like actions you could do. You have two buttons. Mm-hmm. A lot of it is basically like the movement of Mario and the control of Mario and how Mario's jump works in the games. And so like being able to do that twice enhances that potentially. Obviously, that's not the case in most Mario games. But I think that like we were tooling with this idea in Widget Satch a little bit. We ended up not having a double jump, and we have the bounce.
Yeah, we talked about what the boots would upgrade you for.
I think the original Game Jam version did have
was a double jump. When you got the boots.
Yeah,
and I remember that was a discussion that you and Lane had. I think. And yeah, I recall I just stayed out of it.
Yeah,
I think I liked a double jump better, but I think the debate that you guys were having about it, didn't really feel strongly. So I kind of was like, all right, let's see what they figure out. Mm-hmm. And we ended up with jumping on the bots as being the benefit, which got you a higher jump when you did it.
Yes.
Yeah.
Which is again another separate topic. That's kind of the problem with like
kind of like what is in Mario often erroneously described as a double jump, which is when you just jump in sequence. One jump, land. The second time you jump, you get more air.
Yeah, and then
or the triple jump, which is again, you have to land on the ground. It's the third jump still comes from the ground, not in midair.
Yeah,
but that's not the kind of double jump.
Correct. I'm talking about. Right. Yeah, it has to be in the air. And so like I think that, basically what I wanted to talk about with respect to the double jump is that like a lot of the core benefits in my mind is the simplicity of it.
Yeah.
Like I said. Players get it right away. It's relatively easy to implement. There's no additional buttons you need. You just have to press jump again. And it's easier to control for players because you're already jumping. That's your main core mechanic in platformers typically. So if you do another jump, then you can, it's just the same thing, but more of it.
Yeah.
So it allows some flexibility. I think a lot of Metroidvanias tend to lean towards double jumps because, you know, if you have a platform that's twice as high as normal, players would be like, well, I obviously can't reach this jump, but if I had two jumps, then I could make it.
Let's bring Ellen in, because as the Metroid expert.
Yeah, that's true.
Is that true? Because I would have guessed the opposite.
Oh.
Well, I mean, beginning of every Metroid game, you can't do anything.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, like the double jump is one of the earlier abilities you typically access, but you can also generally get some sort of dash at some point. Mm-hmm.
You do get some.
Well.
Yeah, so I know Metroid Dread has a dash, and it also has this space jump and screw attack, which is just the space jump with damage.
Yeah.
And I know that Super Metroid does not have a dash. It has a higher jump, I think. It has a higher jump, and then it has the space jump, which is double jump and more.
Sure.
It doesn't. Yeah, it doesn't have a dash that you can just like. It doesn't have a dash that's as easy and like quick to use as the jump button.
Oh, that's true.
You can mash the jump button over and over again. It's got like the power dash, but you've got to charge that up.
Yeah, the Shine Spark or whatever. Yeah, that's
but
not.
It's different in Super Metroid, but the Shine Spark is slightly different.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
Can
I offer a question/hypothesis?
Certainly.
Okay. Well, what are the things that I think? I was just thinking about the different platformers and Metroidvanias that I've played. When it comes to like a double jump, the feature, or like a space jump, like you said, the feature that it lets you do is you're in midair and lets you jump again from a midair point. Mm-hmm. And like in Metroid, it would let you do that once. And then when you got the, the screw attack in Super Metroid, you could just do it indefinitely and you'd be the spinny wheel.
Yeah.
But you're not really changing your vertical speed at all when you're doing that. You're just getting more access to being able to do it multiple times.
Right.
I feel like the thing that makes the dash feature a little harder to work with is that by definition, it is changing your velocity.
Yes.
So you've spent like hours running at a specific speed and all of a sudden now you have this opportunity to change it. And that just, it's tricky to get, I think it's trickier. It's trickier to get used to.
Well, and I haven't gotten into the dashes in particular, but that is one of the things I wanted to bring up is that like dashes allow for more complex movement potentially in certain aspects. Well, I mean like Metroid Dread had a bunch of like things that required you to dash in order to get through things.
That is where this is my first foot on the ground.
All right.
That dashes are simple.
Okay.
And actually make the game less complex.
Oh, interesting.
Because of exactly what you're talking about.
Okay.
They are essentially keys to keyholes.
Sure.
Whereas a double jump is about giving the player more freedom of movement.
Yeah.
A dash, and that's partly why a dash makes you go faster.
Mm.
Because you hit a button to go to a thing.
Yeah.
To access the gap you couldn't reach before.
Yeah.
It is a specific tool to solve a specific problem that is then peppered throughout all the levels.
Yeah. Okay.
That it tends to be how it works in most games.
Okay.
Which is the core of my frustration.
Okay.
It's no longer platforming.
Okay.
It's now button mash timing, essentially.
I see.
And if a dash were just horizontal movement and not fast, then you'd have to think about the timing more.
Yeah.
The jump timing more and not just the action timing.
Okay.
Right? Because that's the thing about platformers is that it's not about when you press the button.
Right.
Right? It's the when you press the button is part of the symphony of movement.
Yeah.
But in a dash, it's just when you press the button. That's the only thing that matters.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
So, you know, boo. That's the foundation of my objection to dash as a thing that is taking over a lot of platforming mechanics and is appearing in more and more Metroidvania
so,
in particular.
To spin that into a positive.
Uh-huh.
Because you're right. It does do all of those things. And I appreciate that perspective in that like it is effectively, in a lot of ways, it tends to be used as a key for a keyhole, especially in Metroidvanias.
Yeah.
But I think that dashing oftentimes allows for precision in ways that double jumps can't, which is, I guess, why I can see why you prefer double jumps over dashing, because double jumps allows sort of creativity just innately because it's additional jumps. So you have to, in order to solve these problems, you have to figure out how to double jump to get to the second gap. Imagine a hallway and there's spikes on the ceiling and on the ground and you need to go from one platform to another platform and you have a double jump. In order to make it to the second platform, you can't do it with just one jump. You need to time your double jump so that you don't hit the spikes on the top. Right.
So that actually is closer to how dashes usually work.
Okay.
And that it's a very specific.
Yeah.
You need to get it right.
Yeah.
That is just sort of different. Like if you imagine, you know, there's spikes on the ground and the ceiling, and you have to kind of jump and arc a little bit. And then your second jump comes when you fall a little bit.
Mm.
So if you time it just right. I would still say that's better than a dash where you just have to dash through a bunch of a spiky hallway.
Sure.
But it's a similar kind of thing. Where it's the platforming challenge becomes about doing exactly the thing you're supposed to do and not, it's very Kaizo, right? Kaizo Mario, right?
Yeah.
Which is that's enjoyable for people, but then that becomes a lot more about memorization and mastery in a way that like pure platforming is about risk reward and expression. And like actually and traversing, whereas a lot of times in games that are like all those Mario Maker levels, which were all these Kaizo things, those are all just rhythm games.
Yeah,
and rhythm games are great. Mm. Nothing wrong with that, but like they're not platformers anymore.
Sure,
you know. So I think the actual difference is how close to that it becomes.
Okay,
right, and which is there's a wide variety because there's nothing wrong with a lot of games that have some of that.
Yeah,
right. That itself does not make it. And this is all just my opinion.
Oh, yeah.
But I think that when a game is, when its mechanics are geared toward that, because platforming, movement mechanics, fine.
Mm.
But what makes a platformer is level design.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And when your mechanics only are most conducive to a type of level design that requires a player to do exactly this thing, then that's just not as interesting to me.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah.
And that can be true regardless of whether you use a dash or a double jump.
Yeah, yeah.
I just think a dash is just... you're more likely going to design levels that do that.
Yeah. Well, okay, so, like, there are different aspects of dashes that are beneficial outside of strictly platformers.
Sure.
Like there are, you know, side-scrolling beat-em-ups.
Yeah.
Where you do a lot of, you could potentially do a lot of dashes to dodge things. Double jumps are less useful for that purpose.
Correct.
Yeah,
and more action games. Astrobot has a, one of its power-ups is a pretty aggressive forward dash.
Okay.
And it's used a lot for attacking enemies.
Yeah.
But it's also used for platforming.
Yeah.
I have less problem with that because its main use is in the combat mechanic.
Yeah, well, so the dash can be used as like a rapid positioning tool in a way that double jumps are more difficult to do. Well, I think about this actually with respect to Super Smash Brothers. Every character used to have different jump. They all have different jump and double jump properties. Their double jumps might be have different properties than other jumps. So, for instance, Snake, in at least in Ultimate, I think this was the case in Brawl as well. His first jump from the ground is actually has less height than his double jump for some reason. I don't know why. He doesn't double jump in his game, so I don't really know why they made that decision.
Everyone in Smash double jumps.
Yeah, everyone in Smash double jumps.
Which is weird,
doesn't make sense.
But you know, it's part of that game.
That's just how it works.
Yeah.
So I think, a lot of professionals will jump and then immediately double jump so that they can get that extra height right away.
Yeah.
If there was a dash, platforming beat 'em ups or platforming fighting games have opted to use dashes, like in a way that like you wouldn't necessarily have to do that weird double jump fast quick thing.
Yeah.
In order to get the extra height.
And a lot of that is about positioning.
Yes.
And area control.
Right. Yeah. So I think that dashes definitely give you that advantage. They give you that benefit of being able to control your position in ways that double jumps have an issue with.
Probably why I like Meta Knight so much, because it's like screwing attack.
Yeah.
Which is not the same as it is in Metroid, but
yeah,
like is a lot more expressive. And it's not, but it also does the same thing.
Yeah,
as a dash does.
Meta Knight's an interesting example because like he has a ton of jumps in the air. But he has so many, all of his B moves, his special moves allow him to move around, navigate in the air in different ways.
Yeah.
Which is unique to him. And I think that like he becomes very, you get to express yourself more due to all of the different ways that he can navigate in the air.
Yeah.
Which is part of why people start combining dashes and jumps together, is because then you can kind of do a lot of stuff, but then you're doing a lot of stuff and it's kind of like a combo, and it's a little weird for a platformer to do that. But you know, to each their own.
Well, that's the whole dichotomy of Smash, which is it's a fighter, but it's also very platforming.
Mm-hmm.
That's why, you know, that's why they call it the platform fighter.
Because
actually jumping around is like core to the experience.
It's important.
It's why they all have double jumps,
right,
even though it makes no sense at all.
Yes.
But yeah, all that movement stuff lets you sort of, instead of just being like, oh, I need to avoid this person, then I need to do exactly this, then that. Not fun.
Yeah.
But in Smash, you have all those different movement options,
right?
So it and dash is one of them that contributes to this. It allows you to decide in the moment what to do, rather than have to deduce what you're supposed to do,
right?
You know,
yeah. So this is actually really interesting if you think of it with respect to like expression. They allow for different forms of expression, both ones. But I guess a lot of times, like you were saying, Mark, I think a lot of times people will use the tools you have in a platformer to solve particular puzzles.
Yeah, the one that really got me with that really, I think, started my crusade against the dash is in Hollow Knight, where it really is just, I mean, in all Metroidvanias are about locked areas that you get a thing to do it, but it's like in Hollow Knight, the dash is essentially just literally a key.
Mm.
Once you have it, you can then go to places. Like that's how it felt to me anyway.
In a way that I
felt was damning against that level design. But Smash is an example where it's not the mechanic itself that I have a problem with.
Yeah.
It encourages a type of design that feels boring to me.
Yeah, and it doesn't necessarily have to do that. You just have to use it in a different way. But I think that's part of the reason why we leaned away from using double jump or dash really in Widget Satchel.
Yeah.
Is because they start. Because all of the tools you were getting were kind of like keys that you could use in different ways. And we didn't want you to get a movement option that just felt like a key. And so like we avoided that. Ultimately, it is still a movement option, and it's kind of a key. You still have to bounce to get to certain platforms.
Yeah.
But like,
in a broad level, it, you know, everything is about giving the ability to go somewhere.
It's also a bit more signposted. Like,
yeah,
it, because you have to have another bot to bounce off of. You know that I can use this bot, or in this moment, I need this these boots in order to bounce off to get to this thing. Versus a double jump, which just allows you to do everything. And it makes the game feel more flexible when you get it, so it feels more like a necessity in the way that Witch's Satchel works. You can buy them out of order.
Witch's Satchel was so flexible that I think we required that constraint.
By
basically constraining where a double jump could happen.
Right.
So that, or where a high jump could happen.
Yeah. Rather,
so that we wouldn't be like, we wouldn't have these open-ended levels that where anything could happen.
Right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, this is interesting. I've learned a lot about the differences between the two. And I definitely appreciate how expressive both options are in different ways. It's really cool. Mm-hmm. This is why I like digging into the real specifics of it, because it's like, why would you pick this over this thing?
Yeah.
And sometimes it's just a preference thing, but like I think it can definitely change how the game feels and like how players will approach your game as a result. Like I think of Celeste, which is kind of the epitome of dashing, I guess, because a lot of people use it. Or a lot of people speed run it and play that game a lot and think very highly of the dash. And I do too, personally. I like the dash in that.
Dashes are great for speed running because it has a lot of precision, boring gameplay.
Yeah. Okay.
Because it's very, to do good at speed running, the kind of mechanics that can make it good to practice and get good at it require as little creativity as possible.
Yeah.
Like, it's a lot of like solving the problem and then just execution.
Yeah.
And like, and you know, I don't love that.
Yeah.
But that's why a dash is great in Celeste, because that community loves the solving it and the precision and the all of that. That's also why I didn't love Celeste the way other people did.
Sure. That makes sense. That's fair.
Ori and the Blind Forest.
Ori and the Blind Forest. Well, I haven't played that game. I've only watched some of it.
Okay. So I just wanted to put it in there as a potential counterexample.
Okay.
It's one of the things, it has dash. It's been a while since I played it, but it definitely has a dash. I think it has a double jump.
Mm.
Lots of jumping, lots of flying around.
Yeah.
And I think I remember pretty clearly that the dash was like a part of that creative moveset palette that you had to work with.
Yeah.
I think one of the things that made it work, though, was that you had a very small character in a very big environment.
Sure.
And the dash only took you a short way. So in order to get from one point to the other, you had to really move around a lot of different things, and you had a lot of different options for how to make that traversal from one point to the other.
Yeah.
And it was always going to take you a while.
There was very little precision platforming in that game.
Yeah, it's kind of zippy, zippy, zippy.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. You were, yeah, like you say, a little person in a big world. So like, I think I'm with you there. The dash was just a part of the vocabulary rather than more so than other games where the dash is like a specific, this is what this is for.
I see.
Yeah. Here, you're supposed to use this ability.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Which there's, you know, there's nothing wrong with that generally, but when it's like all that and nothing else, then it becomes a problem.
Yeah.
That's an interesting counter.
It's got to be interesting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I think actually it kind of proves my point in that like, you can the way that both of these mechanics can be expressed can vary dramatically in a way that needs to be tuned for your specific game. So I think like having I appreciate you talking about like the size and scale of Ori. Is Ori the main character? Again, I haven't played these games. I'm gonna assume that's a yes.
I don't remember.
I don't know. But like the size and scale of the main character is relatively small compared to your actual movement options, so you need to zip around a bunch of different places and use the environment in order to get to places. So you get a bunch of tools, and you don't necessarily have you have to combine them in certain ways to get to through places in a way that isn't just like there's this gap, and the only way to get to this gap is to dash or whatever.
Yeah,
you know,
right.
It feels a little different.
Yeah. And in a Metroidvania where there's lots of backtracking, like it becomes a pacing tool as well.
That's true.
You know.
Yeah. Yeah. Very interesting. Cool, cool, cool. Let me know, listeners, if you've got opinions on this, what your preference is, double jump versus dash, because I'm curious to hear.
I bet they have opinions.
I hope so.
Yeah.
So, Steven, when are you going to make a platformer the next Game Jam?
Oh, I don't know. I wasn't thinking about that. I just want to talk about this specific thing. It's been a long time since I've I guess the last time I worked on a platformer was Widget Central, huh? Mm-hmm. I haven't worked on one since. Hmm. So I don't know, maybe. We'll see. That'll be fun.
Almost got him on the hook there, folks.
Almost.
No promises.
I'm not committing to a game jam yet.
He's done too many podcasts to be caught on the air like that.
Yeah. No, I get caught on the air plenty of times.
That's our show. For show notes and links on today's topics, go to our website, nicegames.club. Visit us on Threads at Nice Games Club, where Dale posts about game dev resources and the Eternal Cylinder. Reply there on Threads or email us, contact@nicegames.club. Nice Games Club is on Patreon, as I mentioned before. Support the show and get stuff, including ad-free episodes. Sign up at patreon.com/nicegamesclub. And if you want to keep things more casual or share your opinions on Dash versus Double Jump, just stop by nicegames.club/discord and say nice things. Next week, we'll be interviewing Luke Sparevka about puzzles and tutorialization. But that's it for this week.
So, until we start again, remember to
play nice
and make nice. Did you guys hear my dog in the background at all?
No, but we might. It might be in your recording, so we'll see what we can do.
Well, he's like rolling on the ground, going rah, rah, rah.
Oh,
so, yeah. Worst case scenario, we could just put what I just did in the outro.
Sure.
People are driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. The hiring process can be slow and overwhelming. Simplify hiring with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. Listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/PODKATZ12. That's Indeed.com/PODKATZ12. Terms and conditions apply.
If you're a facilities manager at a warehouse and your HVAC system goes down, it can turn up the heat, literally. But don't sweat it, Grainger has you covered. Grainger offers over a million industrial-grade products for all your operations, including warehouse HVAC maintenance. And even better, they offer access to experts and fast delivery, so you and your warehouse can both keep your cool. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.